All right, you can turn with me to the book of Nahum, chapter 2. We are going to we're planning on finishing the book of Nahum tonight. These second two chapters, as we looked at in the introduction, are they're similar. They both are concerned about the judgment on Nineveh and its expansion of the death to the nation that Nineveh represents, to Assyria. And so there's a bit of repetition, and there really is one primary theological theme, and that is that the Lord is against Nineveh. He is against evil. And so since that is repetitive in these second two chapters, we're going to hope to tackle them both together. So you may remember this book from Nahum, the prophet, most likely from Judah, the Elkoshite, the burden against Nineveh. So it's a message to Judah concerning their relationship with Assyria, which has held them as a servant nation. And this is a promise of their deliverance. It's a promise of their freedom. And we've examined the theological theme as well, that in order for the oppressor to be, in order for the oppressed to be freed, the oppressor must be brought low. And that is one of the reasons for this dramatic language about Nineveh, because as we'll see a little bit more tonight, these were, as chapter 3 verse 1 says, these were very bloodthirsty people. These were extraordinarily evil. It's an evil nation, and they're representative even of evil in general. And so this is a statement of God's nature against that, and his promise that he will bring it low, he will bring it down. So we left off in chapter 1, 15, with the good news coming from the messenger off of the mountains. That's, behold, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. O Judah, keep your appointed feast, perform your vows, for the wicked one shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. So there's the announcement of victory as the messenger returns from battle to give us news. And the news is good. It is that the divine warrior has been victorious, and he's bringing shalom. He's bringing this whole, complete well-being in himself, this message that God brings peace, and he's doing it by the only means possible, which is his justice. And that results in worship. And these things, as I'll hope to have a few minutes at the end to talk about how this book functions as a representative of evil, but this verse particularly is foreshadowing the conquering of evil by Christ, which enables others to carry the good news of shalom, right? So that's where we left off, is the messenger has come down, there's good news. And now this messenger gives the account of the battle. So chapters 2 and 3 are pretty dramatic, and they detail out this attack from Babylon and the Medes, this sort of association of nations that have come against Assyria, and it details out their destruction. So let's look at verses 1 through 7. We'll read those. And verses 1 through 7 is about the city being taken. So he says, he who scatters has come before your face. Man the fort, watch the road, strengthen your flanks, fortify your power mightily. For the Lord will restore the excellence of Jacob like the excellence of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and ruined their vine branches. The shields of his mighty men are made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots come with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the spears are brandished. The chariots rage in the streets. They jostle one another in the broad roads. They seem like torches. They run like lightning. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their walk. They make haste to her walls. But the defense is prepared. The gates of the river are opened, and the palace is dissolved. It is decreed she shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maidservant shall lead her, as with the voice of doves beating their breasts. Okay, so these first two verses, we'll take them initially. He who scatters has come before your face. So he who scatters could be a reference to the Lord, but is more likely a reference to Babylon and the Medes. So it's a word to Assyria, and he's saying, they're here, right? The judgment has arrived. The one who's going to scatter you is in at your gates, basically. So then there's a call to defense. There's a call to go ahead and do what you can to get ready, which you'll see that ends up being the end of chapter 3 as well. He says it's coming, so get ready. So there's this sort of series of commands, all right? Man the fort, watch the road, strengthen flanks, fortify your power, how? Mightily. Do all of these things mightily. Do all of these things to the best of your abilities, because he who scatters has come. It's time for you to be brought low. Which seems, again, if you remember chapter 1, it seems to be an impossible thing that God would be able even to bring down the Assyrian Empire. This is the strongest, mightiest, most brutal empire that has ever been. So, it's a call to action to them. Man the fort, watch the road, strengthen your flanks, fortify your power. Why? Because, now interestingly, the Lord will restore the excellence of Jacob. So now we're back to the Lord using the means of this mighty scatterer, the Lord using the means of the Babylonian Empire to restore the excellence of Jacob. So quite a negative note in verse 1 and quite a positive note in verse 2. And that would bring us back once again to remember that this is a positive message to the oppressed. This is a word of comfort to Judah. Verse 1 is inherently comforting to Judah in verse 2. So the Lord is going to restore the excellence of Jacob like the excellence of Israel. Remember that they're looking back to former days, back when David was king, back when Solomon was king, when Zion was magnificent. And so he's going to make it better even than that. And then he uses sort of a statement of emptiness, right? Because the emptiers have emptied them out. This is what Assyria has done to them. Assyria is the emptier. So you have Babylon as the scatterer and Assyria as the emptier. And Judah is the ruined vine branch. It's just completely broken here. This same vineyard imagery is going to come. We'll remember this when we get to chapter 3. Verse 12. All your strongholds to Assyria are fig trees with ripened figs. If they are shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. So Assyria is about to be shaken, scattered, in the same way that they have shaken and scattered other nations. Okay, so they're getting what's coming to them, basically. Okay, so then 3 and 4 describe the battle itself, okay? There's so much parallelism here. We don't have time to walk through it. A lot of it is maintained really well in English here, so it's helpful. We can see it all over the place. The shields of his mighty men are made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. So there seems to be this red army that is arriving at the gates, even probably related to their raiment or the paint on their shields. It could also be that their shields are about to be bloody. But that's the end. So the shield is red. The men are dressed in scarlet. And then you'll see that throughout here, the chariots are one of their primary means of conquering the city. The chariots come with flaming torches in the day of preparation. Then you have spears are brandished. Chariots rage in the streets. The chariots jostle one another in the broad roads. I guess you'd have chariots rage in the streets. They jostle in the broad roads. They seem like torches. So there's this sort of lightning aspect to it. There's a brilliance probably in relationship to the metal on the chariots. So there's this progression, right? You have these men outside wearing red, and then there's just this flash of chariots and spears, and it's chaotic, it's raging, it's fast, it's violent. That's what's happening to Assyria. And we might try to use the swift language in other ways, like if a plane is screaming towards something. Like that's sort of a similar language, that the chariot is just flying like a lightning strike onto Assyria. So it's quite a dramatic depiction of Nineveh's judgment, as Assyria is faced with one who will do to them as they have done to others. One illustration I intended to use on verse 2, which does seem out of place, doesn't it? How do you have this word of comfort right before the word of great violence? But perhaps I was just considering even maybe modern-day warfare. If you have this Navy SEAL on a rescue mission for a hostage, and he finds it's a little girl, right? And he finds this little girl, and she's chained up, and he turns to her, and there's this, like, maybe a touch on her arm. This is, I'm here, it's going to be okay. And then he turns around to the oppressor, and it's about to be very violent and perhaps bloody and fast, and just that's kind of the imagery, right? It's but for that little girl, what a comfort, right? To have this violent man, this good violent man in her presence. The Lord's going to restore her. Okay? So then, interestingly, verse 5 is probably the response of Nineveh. So the king kind of wakes up and he remembers, he's like, oh yeah, I have an army too. He remembers his nobles. And so they, in this panic, in this stumbling nature, they go back to the walls. They're going to go and try and make this defense, maybe cast down the siege engines of the Babylonians. And so they're quickly trying to get to the wall. It's not a good and organized defense, but they're going to there. And either this final statement means, and they get their defense ready, they're as ready as they can be, or it's actually in contrast, it's but the defense, like the siege defense, like the siege engine, has already been prepared against them. It's too late. Babylon has already established their attack in a way that the Ninevite defense will not be able to overcome. So either way, you have this sort of fumbling defense against a very powerful lightning strike of an attack. Verse 6 is very interesting. It kind of introduces water into the mix. The gates of the river are opened. This could mean a couple different things. It could mean that they're in their preparation for the siege, that the Babylonians and the Medes have captured the water supply. Nineveh was right beside a great river, and so perhaps they're just cutting off the flow of water into the city. That certainly could be true. That is a very normal way that you would seek to sort of starve out a city, is to take out their water supply. But probably because of the nature of how quick and fast and powerful this attack is described as, and in correlation, There's an ancient Greek historian named Diodorus Siculus who records that a series of heavy rains swelled the Euphrates, which is an error for the Tigris, and it flooded parts of the city. So there would have been ducts from the river that came into the city, and the idea is that Babylon opened those gates and the river was pregnant with water. It was overflowing, and it just rushed into Nineveh and destroyed a part of the wall. That was what Diderus recorded. It said it flooded parts of the city and overthrew the wall for about a length of 20 stadia, which is about 2 miles. So a massive piece of the Ninevite defense was broken by the great river that was flooding. If that is the case, then it's also a statement of an undeniable statement of God's interaction along with the Babylonians in the overthrow of Assyria. It's also possible in all the poetry of the moment that it's simply a metaphor, like the lightning striking and the water flooding. That's just a description of the Babylonians flooded into the city. But the second phrase that it relates to, and the palace is dissolved. That is like the palace, whether of the king or perhaps of the gods, the temple, was melting away. So it seems like if the great river flooded into the city, that it took out part of the fortifying nature, part of the he remembering his nobles, like it went right into the palace doors and even affected its foundation. So anyways, the water is now interacting in this attack, because it has been decreed, it is established, here's the result of this whole attack. She shall be led away captive, she shall be brought up, and her maidservants shall lead her as with the voice of doves beating their breast. So Nineveh is portrayed as this woman, maybe even the queen city of Assyria. And the host, this Nineveh, was the host of the temple of Ishtar, the Assyrian goddess. Right? And so she, this city, this god, this great capital of Assyria, is now in exile. She's brought low. And her people, her maidservants, go out in front of her, and they are mourning, right, with the voice of a dove, like the coo or the mourn, the cry of a group of mourners, and beating their breasts. So it's the sackcloth and ashes image. There, they've just been completely brought low. So there is the attack on the city, the breach of Nineveh. Then you have the plundering of Nineveh in verses 8 through 10. So here's what Nineveh used to be. Nineveh of old was like a pool of water. Don't totally know what that means. It could be the picture kind of an oasis, that it was this place of abundance. It was a place of safety. There's perhaps these fountains flowing out of this ancient city that was strong. And now it's not like that anymore. Now they're running away. All the people are fleeing. Right? They've gone out before her, mourning and crying. And the leaders are trying to get them to stop. Right? Halt, halt, they cry. But no one turns back. It's over. Okay, so this great place of old, this fountain, this oasis, is now abandoned because it's been destroyed. And Babylon gets to do what they want with the city. Take spoil of silver, take spoil of gold. There is no end of treasure or wealth of every desirable prize. Because remember who they've just brought down. This is the capital city of the first empire of the ancient world. Right? This is, you get everything. You get all of the gold and the silver. You get all of the animals. You get all of the servants. You get all of the food and the vineyards and everything. You get the whole thing. And this is the greatest prize that had ever been gotten from a material perspective. So there's no end of it. Leaving Nineveh unlike she has ever been before. Empty, desolate, and waste. Now if you remember back to verse 1, how have they treated Judah? They are the emptiers. They've emptied them out, ruined them. And now Nineveh is emptied and ruined. Okay, so their own vineyards have been trampled and shaken. Just continuing in the poetry, he now turns to consider this person, this woman. She is empty, desolate, and waste. He now sort of paints a picture of her physique. Heart melts, knees are shaking, her sides are filled with pain, and her faces are drained. Her face is drained of color. Interestingly, in Hebrew, her face is actually full of light, or of brightness. It's like she's so pale. So we would say drained. They might say filled with light. Everything, she's just been now completely brought to nothing. Her courage is gone. That which was steady is now trembling. That which was filled with fullness and food and fatness is just filled with pain and ache and heartbreak. And that which was, again, maybe full of color is drained and is white. Okay, so complete loss, complete emptiness. 11 through 13, Nahum changes the metaphor completely. So for the rest of chapter 2, he's done with this, he refers to chariots again in 13, but the imagery of the city is kind of done, and he moves to consider a lion in its den. So previously, Nineveh and Assyria were the lions of the east. Right? They did whatever they wanted. So where is the dwelling of the lions? The feeding place of the young lions, where the lion walked, the lioness and the lion's cub, and no one made them afraid. The lion tore in pieces enough for his cubs, killed for his lionesses, filled his caves with prey, and his dens with flesh. So you kind of have the place. And then the activity. So they were first walking, right? This is where they lived. And then they're tearing and killing and filling. Okay? So this is what the lions are doing. And it's kind of a part A and part B with this right in the middle. So previously, lions roamed the lands, right? The greatest animal can do whatever it wants. It can go wherever it wants. It's unafraid. It's where they live. It's where they eat. This is Nineveh. This is the dwelling place. It's the cave of the lions. And the key was because they were the greatest, right? Why not make your home wherever you want? Why not make it as splendid as you want? Why not fill it the way that you want to fill it? You can do anything you want because they're the greatest, right? So you're not afraid. Now, then he ends up interacting with the other animals, right? And we've seen documentaries or National Geographic or whatever. It's pretty violent out there, isn't it? Because the stronger animals can do whatever they want with the weaker animals, and so that's the image. He's tearing, he's killing, he's filling. It is just violent, ripping, doing whatever he wants. Now the problem is he's talking about humans. And that's what they were doing to each other. And that is quite literally what Assyria was doing to its victims. I'll read a little bit about that at the end. But he describes just kind of this brutal provision, right? Anything for his kids, anything to make his woman and his little cubs just happy. Okay. The problem is, now there's a bigger and a better lion that's arrived on the scene. And it's the Lord in verse 13. Behold, I am against you. And that is the greatest theological statement in chapters 2 and 3. That's the theme. We'll see it one other time. God makes this statement of what he's against and then what he's going to do about it. Okay, so I am against you, says the Lord of hosts. Now, that in contrast to the lion, right? The Yahweh who commands the angel armies compared to a strong lion, right? Albeit a powerful image. He's like, there's no contest here. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword will devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall be heard no more. So once again, in poetic fashion, Nahum records that God is going to bring them low. So he, once again, is identified as the source, even though he uses Babylon and he uses the Medes. God is behind it. Okay, so he's the one that comes against the lion of the east. Chapter 3, he is going to describe a little bit more of the motives of why God's going to do this. He assigns some accusation, not at all in the same form as he's done at other times with the sort of the court scene, not like that, but he does give the reason explicitly that this great violence has come upon them. So he starts with this woe to the bloody city, which is kind of this cry against them, like this agony or pain of an offense that is being witnessed. So he has watched them time and time again as they have slowly calculated and crushed the way, or like they've calculated the way in which they can crush and squeeze the last breath out of their victims. Like this is a very intentional thing that Assyria has been about, and God has observed it. And so now there's this like cry against them. Like there's the pain is filled up to overflowing. It's time to be done. And so he cries out against this bloodthirsty city, right? Woe to the bloody city. We'll read through verse 4. It is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs. The noise of the whip and the noise of rattling wheels, of galloping horses, of clattering chariots, horsemen charged with bright sword and glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain, a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses. Because of the multitude of harlotries of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries. So he begins with a bit of an accusation and ends in 4 with accusation. In 2 and 3, you have kind of a restatement of what happened in 1 through 7 of chapter 2. It's the fall of the city again. So woe to the bloody city, and he describes its characteristics, right? A deceptive city, a city that was out for its own gain. It was willing to take from even its own people and certainly from any people outside of it to just do whatever it wants. Its victim never departs, meaning there's always somebody that he's victimizing. It's just always present before him, like this lion who's out and just always tearing another piece of prey into bits for its family. So God is full to overflowing with having seen enough of this. And so in a very, it's like a sharp staccato fashion, a lot like the lightning chariots from chapter 2. He just describes once again the quick and rapid overthrow of the city. So the noise, the cracking whip, the rattling wheels, galloping horses and clattering chariots. It's just, there's this mounting noise, and even the bodies at the end are like piling up. There's a multitude of people who keep trampling underneath, and they're just, the pile of bodies is basically getting bigger and bigger. Countless corpses, and they're just stumbling over them, marching over them, walking over them, kind of like the lion did previously. So there's a new great one in the safari, I guess. So the reason is given in verse 4. And she, Nineveh, is identified kind of as the harlot of all harlots. There's no one more seductive than her. And if we could easily go back and spend some time in the first chapters of Proverbs to get an image of who this woman is. This is Lady Folly incarnate, but she's, as Nineveh, she's also a lot like Lady Follett, she's very violent, right? The end after the seduction is death. So much like this lady as well, she's out and about in the town. She's seeking her next victim. She grabs hold of him and she kisses him and brings her into her lair. So that's kind of the picture that's being painted here. I would like to go back and probably will and study verse 4 a little bit more to see if I understand the pagan elements of it. The mistress of sorcery. Some of these phrases are very unique. Like the mistress of sorceries. Who sells nations through harlotries and sells families through sorceries. So this the sorcery element is kind of unique here in Nahum. And I know that there's been some, in the archaeology of Nineveh, there has been some unearthing of these tablets, almost like large kind of amulets or things that it looked like they would sell in order to guarantee the favor of God, of the gods, and all sorts of different aspects of life. And what seems to be happening is that they've gotten the people to believe that it works, and so they're destroying the society. Nineveh is as the woman, the prostitute. She's destroying the society, the families, and the nations through these sorceries, through believing that this demonic religion is real and that it works. And she's leading people to the slaughter by those means. So I like to do a little bit more work on that because the sorceries there is kind of a unique thing. Sort of like Egypt, like the magicians in the court, that sort of thing, that they were able to do miraculous things through demons, through the power of demons. So it's kind of a unique element there, but it certainly is alluding to the dark and seductive sorcery that's occurring in the Ninevite land. And that's why this is happening, right? That's why they're being annihilated the way that they are. That's why God is fed up with seeing it. And so in probably one of the most dramatic ways in series of poems here at the end of, or throughout the middle of chapter 3, God describes exactly what he's going to do. Okay, so we have this once again, "Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts," exactly like chapter 2, verse 13 says. And there's a series of five things that God promises he's going to do to them in relation to their harlotry. So he continues with that same imagery. The first is that he's going to lift their skirts over their face. So they're going to be exposed for who they truly are, right? In a very shameful way. And it's not just something that this is not a God to Assyria behind closed doors confrontation. This is a global exposure, right? Everyone is going to see it. "I will show the nations your nakedness, and the kingdoms your shames." That line goes together. Not only is he going to leave Nineveh in this very vulnerable position, but he's going to cast abominable filth upon them. So perhaps like medieval times, you know, you have this person in the stocks, which is shameful enough. It's a public thing. It's a very exposing thing. But now the crowd begins to throw rotten vegetables at them, right? To just add insult to injury, I suppose. Insult to insult. He's going to throw mud, dirt, and it doesn't have to be clean mud or dirt, right? It's just like he's going to make them filthy, make them vile, make them a spectacle, and that's four and five. They're each unique statements, the things that he's going to do. but all in order to, it kind of moves from, I'm going to do this, but I'm doing it before other people. I lift your skirts, but I'm showing the nations your nakedness. I cast filth on you and make you vile, but the purpose is to make you a spectacle. It's that many eyes would observe this. So the result of that, of God's activity, is that then all these people who see her, which is the whole point, all these people who see her flee from her. And they say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? And then God replies with one of the first of three rhetorical questions to establish the point that he's trying to make throughout chapter 3. And the first one is the assurance of her destruction is that there is no one that cares. No one comforts her. Everyone is glad for this because everyone has been emptied by her. So they all are just going to run away and be like, I don't feel sorry for that person, right? And God himself says, I can't find anyone to feel sorry for you. I certainly don't. So it's pretty dark. Like that series right there is one of the most like explicit of how God is going to treat her. I'll just note them now in case you're kind of marking down too. So that's the first rhetorical question. The next one is the next verse. Are you better than Lo Ammon? Is kind of the question. And then the last verse of the chapter, for upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually? Those are the three rhetorical questions. So their judgment is assured in verses 1 through 7 because of their sin, as exposed in verse 4. And God is going to make sure that because he's against them, he'll expose her. Their judgment is also assured in verses 8 through 13. He uses an example of Lo Ammon. Now, you may remember back to the introduction. So Lo Ammon was the capital city of Egypt. It was the splendor of Egypt, and it was very secure. It was wonderfully placed geographically, had a lot of natural defenses to it. It also was safe because it had many neighboring allies, so it was hard to get to because there was a circle of friends around it. It was hard to get to because there was an intricately woven series of rivers and kind of this web of rivers around it that protected it. There were mountains around it, a lot of good natural defenses, and then a lot of people around it defending it. But Assyria took it down. Assyria was the one that traveled, and they made their way in their great armies. The armies of the east traveled south. And the fall of Lo Ammon, or Thebes is the name of the city. So the fall of Thebes, which is the capital city of Upper Egypt, happened by one of the Assyrian kings about 50 years before this, so in like 664 BC. And God is using them as an example through Nahum. He says, do you think you're more powerful than Thebes? Because if you look back at it, they had everything for them. They were situated by the river, and he uses water again, right? Because Nineveh knows they have water on their side too. They're situated right powerfully beside a really, really big river. They were situated by the river that had waters all around her, whose rampart, there's the defense, was the sea, whose wall was the sea, so there's all this water. And then you have her neighbors, right? Ethiopia, Egypt, they were her strength, and it was boundless. They too had the seemingly endless supply of resources. Put and Lubim were your helpers, so there's strength all around her. And yet, as you know, Assyria, what happened to her? She was carried away. She went into captivity, and it was violent because it was at the hands of Assyria. Her young children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. So note, he's trying to make out Thebes to look far more powerful than Nineveh was. Because if she, or maybe even he, was destroyed, then certainly she will be destroyed. Now, there's many mighty men that were there, and they ended up in chains. And so then he proceeds, Nahum proceeds, like, if that happened to Noamon, to Thebes, then certainly it's going to happen to you. And he begins, you also, Assyria, will be drunk. You will be hidden. You will seek refuge. So you're going to be like a drunk man who cannot find his way. You're going to be like a refugee on the run, or someone who's fleeing from the violent one that was sort of described earlier. Right? All the leaders may be calling halt, halt, but everyone's out, everyone's gone. You seek refuge from the enemy. You're going to be shaken as you have shaken other people. So he's like a perfectly ripe fig tree, where if you just basically kicked or shook branch, all the fruit's going to fall off. It's that ready to fall, is what he's saying about Nineveh. They fall into the mouth of the eater, so there's the devouring aspect. And then he describes them as women. He says, surely everyone in your midst is like a woman, in contrast to the honorable and great men who were just bound. And so he's comparing the physical strength of the two. If the great man is bound, then certainly the woman is going to be bound as well, is his argument. Especially if the gates of your land are wide open for your enemies, fire is going to devour the bars of your gates. I believe here's the first time that we have fire in contrast to water as the destructive force. So there's this greater to the lesser argument. If the greater Thebes was taken down, certainly Nineveh is going to be taken down as well. So what should Nineveh do about it? Go ahead and get ready. You can fight back. Give it your best shot. Right? And that's exactly what he goes for. Okay, so Nineveh, draw your water for the siege. Fortify your strongholds. Go into the clay, tread the mortar, make strong the brick kiln. So build up your defenses. Make your walls as with the strongest brick that you can make. There the fire will devour you. I'm going to do that. The sword is going to cut you off. So you have the fire again here. It's going to eat you up like a locust. And here he begins the last main image in the book, and that is of locusts. And so there's good things that are, or sort of powerful things about locusts that are used. And then he tells them to also be like the locust. So he says, it's going to eat you up like a locust, right? Because a great swarm of locusts devours things. So there's the threat. But then he says, make yourself many like the locust. So there's also strength in numbers. He's sort of pitting two attributes of the locust against each other, right? God's going to come like a devouring swarm of locusts. But you go ahead, make yourself many like the locust. So which will be better, or the devouring force or the numerical force? So make yourself many like the locust. Make yourself many like the swarming locusts. You have multiplied as a locust, your merchants more than the stars of heaven. But the locust plunders and flies away. Your commanders are like swarming locusts, right? There's a lot of them. And your generals are like great grasshoppers which camp in the edges on a cold day. But when the sun rises, they're also going to be gone. They're going to flee away. So there's the leaving aspect of the locust. So there's just, okay, just like a lot of poetic interplay about all these different attributes of a locust. I guess the third one would be that they fly away, right, that they leave. When the sun rises, they're gone, and the place where they are, which you kind of need your generals and your commanders in the time of battle, but you can't find them. He doesn't know where they are. And here, then, is the attack on leadership. So if the commanders and generals have fled, then the shepherds slumber. So the king is asleep, which is kind of how it sounded when the attack started in chapter 2. He sort of wakes up in verse 5 and remembers that he has nobles. He remembers that he has an army, and they stumble out to try and get ready. So the shepherds slumber, the nobles rest in the dust. The result is the people are scattered on the mountains and no one gathers them because the shepherd was asleep. The nobles are resting in the dust. We talked about this as well in the introduction. I believe it was a question that Eric had asked, but then in verse 19, that he points out one of the distinctive aspects of this judgment. This judgment will never get better. This judgment has no healing. The wound is severe. It's put them in critical condition. They're going to die based on this wound. And nobody cares. Everyone's excited. Everyone's glad that this whore of whores has her skirt over her head and has mud thrown at her and is bleeding out. Everyone's very glad for that. They're clapping their hands over her. There's rejoicing. It's a celebration. It's a party. Kind of like in previous minor prophets, we've seen, hey, don't tell the enemies about this. Don't tell them of the fall of Judah, because they're going to rejoice over Zion. They're going to rejoice over her downfall, her destruction. So everyone's glad. Why is everyone glad? That's the rhetorical question. Well, who hasn't been affected by this? Assyria touched everyone. They afflicted everyone. So everyone's glad. Right? It's actually not just the deliverance of Judah. It's the deliverance of many people. This is freedom and plunder and rejoicing, even for the Babylonians, right? They're glad. Everyone's glad. All of the vassal nations are rejoicing that they don't have such a brutal oppressor. So the question still remains, it's very dark as far as, and violent as far as God's response. Is that okay that that's how he responds? Not just that he, you know, meets out judgment and that he says, hey, you know, okay, capital punishment, Nineveh needs to be destroyed. Maybe we could all even get behind that because of how violent and vicious they've been. But like the public mockery seems to be a step further, seems to be something more than what's necessary. Like, do we really need that is kind of the question. And so I just wanted to conclude here by reading two different things. One of them is actually a historical description from Assyria that's been discovered in archaeology about what the kings were bragging about, why they should have been immortalized as the kings of Assyria because of their great feats of violence. So I just wanted to read that and then quickly address, I found a really helpful commentator named William Henry Green, and he kind of described how this functions in relationship even to Isaiah, how this functions to represent not just Nineveh, but all of evil. It's intended as a prophecy against evil, not just Nineveh. So those two things. Do we feel bad about how maybe exposing or public this display is? So here's from a king that was about 100 years before Nahum in Assyria. I built a pillar over against his city gate, this nation he's attacking, and I flayed all the chief men who had revolted, and I covered the pillar, the siege engine, with their skins. Some I walled up within the pillar, and some upon the pillar on stakes I impaled, and others I fixed to stakes round about the pillar. Many within the border of my own land I flayed, and I spread their skins upon the walls. And I cut off the limbs of the high officers, of the royal officers who had rebelled. Many captives from among them I burned, and many I captured alive. From some I cut off their hands and their fingers, and from others I cut off their noses and their ears, and the eyes of many men I put out. I made one heap of the living and another of the heads, and I bound their heads to vines round about the city. Their young men and maidens I burned in the fire. They deserved to be exposed, right? We're not just talking about a bad guy. We're talking about the purest evil that exists in our world. And that deserves to not just be put away quietly. Well, let's just set them over here. Let's bury them 6 feet under. No, let's not bury them at all. Right? The divine judge says, let me show everyone exactly what evil deserves. And this is what evil deserves. And he exposes it and shows it for exactly what it is. Now, how is that related to the greater display of God's judgment on evil? Is that true of what Nahum's oracle is? Is it just about Assyria, or is it more than that? Now, in Isaiah's prophecy, which predates Nahum, Nahum quotes a part of Isaiah, Isaiah 52:7. In fact, I'm just going to read that. And Isaiah is using this as God's work of redemption for Israel away from Babylon. So in Isaiah 52:7, this will sound familiar. This was the end of chapter 1, verse 15. He says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns." So Nahum's quoting Isaiah. He's using the same imagery of someone coming with good news off the mountain for deliverance. But Isaiah's prophecy was actually, it was going further in history than Nahum's was. So Isaiah said it first, and his fulfillment was after. Nahum restates Isaiah, and his fulfillment from Assyria and deliverance came first, right? So there's sort of a logical connection there. If Nahum is saying the same thing as Isaiah, but Isaiah's fulfillment was about even the next nation that came beyond Assyria, then we're talking about something beyond just an individual nation. There's a pattern at play here. So William Henry Green, he includes that Nahum applies Isaiah's precise words about deliverance from Babylon to Assyria's defeat as a way of calling attention to the connection which really exists between the two events, as in essence, really one thing that's happening. Paul, of course, picks up this language in Romans 10, verse 17. And the implication then would be that there is this oneness even in the message which announced the fall of those great persecuting powers and the erection of the kingdom afterward that supplants them. Right? So, because Paul's using it in Romans 10 in the gospel context. So, the conclusion is that Nahum's prediction has a meaning for all time. It's not just about a city that was evil. It's about all of the evil that is represented by this city. And here's a direct quote from Green. He says, "So long as there remains aught in which the spirit of Nineveh survives, aught which has inherited its criminality and its hostility to God's people, the doom of Nineveh shall attach in substance, if not in form, to all its successors. Not until the last foe of God and of human salvation shall be finally destroyed, shall it, in its full import, be accomplished." So the prophecy of Nahum is not finished, right? It wasn't finished with Nineveh. It wasn't finished with Babylon. Neither was Isaiah's prophecy finished with Babylon, because they're talking about something so much greater. And those things will only be finished in part now with the good news of the gospel, right? The good news of what's going to happen. We have sort of the next prophecy in the series of prophecies. We have greater knowledge. We have more clarity about what the end exactly looks like. But it's not over. The skirt has not been lifted enough, right? We're still living in the midst of a great and terrible evil, as poetically portrayed by this wicked seductress, right? Going back even to the first seduction. Who is this serpent, right? He is the evil one. So it's not until he is finally destroyed as the last enemy to be destroyed that Nahum is fulfilled. So that's the message, theologically, that God, behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts, and I will, dot, dot, dot. Going back to chapter 1, can he? Is he able to? Yes, he is. This is his character. He is omnipotent. This is what he's able to do. So that's the message of Nahum. I do want to open it up if you have any comments or questions before we conclude this book. Yeah.
Yeah, contributing to that idea with the language in verse 4, chapter 3, verse 4, you find that in Revelation, the sorceries, the mention of harlotries and sorceries together. And that's, in the context of Revelation, that's a war against the nations.
Mm-hmm. Which is a war on demonic leadership. It is a war on all wickedness. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And that same verse of Nahum 3, verse 4, I have a reference here to Isaiah 47:9, talking about the mistress of witchcrafts, and for what that might be worth. I went back and read it. It wasn't exactly an aha moment, but it still mentioned it, and that it's been ongoing.
Yeah, the multitude of sorceries, the abundance of enchantments. And again, that's talking about Babylon. I think it functions probably in a number of ways to be in the same way that Nahum is against evil. So many themes within these are talking about more than just the nations. And that's a great argument with the Isaiah coming before and being fulfilled after, and Nahum kind of inside that. Coming after Isaiah and being fulfilled before him, but they're talking about the same thing. So that's a helpful argument.
It's the same adversary, Satan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's no reason why he shouldn't be consistent down through the history of the world.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure we'll probably come across this theme again in the Minor Prophets, but I would like to do a little bit more work, even just on that word, on the sorceries and enchantments type of thing, that it is interesting language. Yeah, man.
For me, the imagery is not just in Revelation, but the imagery is in the cross. I mean,
the shame, you mean?
Everything. The shame, the violence. Like, the suffering of Christ was a violent suffering. Shame, the nakedness,
exposure, public
exposure,
display,
all the judgment, all the things that you described and that name described and you pointed out for us, Jesus experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the wholeness of biblical theology,
that God did it to his son.
That for you're correct, we're waiting the final installment, the consummation, but I have shalom.
Mm-hmm.
I have peace.
Right.
But that peace did not come because God decided to, like, I'll let you go. I have shalom because Jesus was treated as Nineveh in my place.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm Nineveh.
Right.
And so I agree 100% with what you said. I would just add to it. As far as I'm concerned, us Christians, we are concerned when Jesus said it is finished, he was saying the evil has been judged, the evil in me
right.
has been judged because on Jesus, because it says he became sin, he became Nineveh, he became what a psychopath is. That's what he
Yeah, that's very helpful. That's beautiful. I appreciate you making that comment. Our place as Nineveh has been handled. It's kind of hard to say anything after that, so let's close in a word of prayer.